The Omnivore's Dilemma, reading assignment number 4, starts on page 76 to 82, and then chapter 10. I'll pause between 76 to 82 and chapter 10 to explain that we are moving to the second food chain, the industrial organic food chain. Page 76 is chapter 7, Fat from Corn. Can you eat more, please? Part 2. So food companies have been very successful at getting us to pay more for the same food. What about their other money-making scheme to get us to buy and eat more food than we need? How has that worked out? Well, let's see. 3 of every 5 Americans are overweight. 1 of every 5 is obese. Among kids, it's almost as bad. 17% of kids aged 6 through 19 are obese. This is a giant public health problem costing the healthcare system an estimated $90 billion a year. The disease formerly known as adult onset diabetes has had to be renamed type 2 diabetes since it now occurs so frequently in children. And the Centers for Disease Control estimates that 1 in 3 American children born in 2000 will develop it. Diabetes can mean blindness, amputation, and early death. Because of diabetes and all other health problems caused by obesity, kids in the U.S. today may turn out to be the first group of Americans with lifespans that are shorter than their parents. To put it simply, Americans are getting fatter and it's killing us. You hear plenty of explanations for our expanding waistline. We sit all day at desks in school or at work, then sit around all night watching television. We play video games instead of sports. Fast food advertising encourages us to eat supersized meals. It is actually cheaper to eat high-calorie, fatty processed foods than whole foods. All these explanations are true, but they don't tell the whole story. Extra calories. Behind our epidemic of obesity lies this simple fact. When food is abundant and cheap, people will eat more of it. Since 1977, an American's average daily intake of calories has jumped by more than 10%. Since we aren't exercising more, the calories end up being stored away in fat cells in our bodies. Where did all of those cheap calories come from? If you've read this far, you already know the answer. Most of them come from cheap corn. Since 1970, farmers in the United States have managed to produce 500 additional calories per person every day. The average person needs about 2,000 calories a day, but that number varies greatly depending on your age, size, and the amount of exercise. Where are those calories going? Some are sold overseas, some are turned into ethanol for our cars, but a lot of them are going into us. An awful lot of those extra corn calories are being eaten as high fructose corn syrup. Not surprisingly, HFCS is the leading source of sweetness in our diets. A sweet deal. In 1985, the average American consumed 45 pounds of high fructose corn syrup a year. In 2006, it was 58 pounds. You may think that it has replaced other sweeteners in the American diet, but that isn't so. In addition to the extra high fructose corn syrup, Americans are eating more old-fashioned cane sugar, too. In fact, since 1985, our consumption of all sugars, cane, beet, HFCS, glucose, honey, maple syrup, whatever, has climbed from 126 pounds to 139 pounds per person. That's what makes high fructose corn syrup such a sweet deal for the food industry, since we like sweet things. Adding it to our food increases the amount we eat. Read the food labels in your kitchen and you'll find that high fructose corn syrup is everywhere. It's not just in our soft drinks and snack foods, but in the ketchup and mustard, the breads and cereals, the relishes and crackers, the hot dogs and hams. But it is in soft drinks that we consume most of our 58 pounds of high fructose corn syrup. We can trace this back to the year 1980, an important year in the history of corn. That was the year corn first became an ingredient in Coca-Cola. By 1984, Coca-Cola and Pepsi had switched over entirely from sugar to high fructose corn syrup. Why? Because high fructose corn syrup was a few cents cheaper than sugar and consumers couldn't taste the difference. The soft drink makers could have just switched one sugar for another. That would not have led us to drink more. But that wasn't all they did. They began to increase the size of a bottle of soda. High fructose corn syrup was so cheap that Pepsi and Coke could have cut the price of each bottle they sold, but they had a much better idea. They would supersize their sodas. Since corn sweetener was now so cheap, why not get people to pay just a few pennies more for a bigger bottle? Drop the price per ounce, but sell a lot more ounces. Did you ever see an old-fashioned Coke bottle from around 1950? It looks tiny because it only held 8 ounces. Today, the standard size of a Coke or Pepsi is 20 ounces. Supersize! Soda makers don't deserve credit for the invention of supersizing. That belongs to a man named David Wallerstein. In the 1950s, Wallerstein worked for a chain of movie theaters in Texas. Movie theaters make most of their profits from their snack counters, not from ticket sales. It was Wallerstein's job to figure out how to sell more soda and popcorn. Wallerstein tried everything he could think of, but found he simply could not get customers to buy more than one soda and one bag of popcorn. He thought he knew why. Going for seconds makes people feel piggish. Wallerstein discovered that people would buy more popcorn and soda, a lot more, as long as it came in a single giant serving. Thus was born the 2-quart bucket of popcorn and the 64-ounce Big Gulp. In 1968, Wallerstein went to work for McDonald's, but try as he might, he couldn't convince Ray Kroc, the company's founder, to try supersizing. "If people want more fries," Kroc told him, "they can buy 2 bags. Wallerstein explained that McDonald's customers want more, but didn't want to buy a second bag. They don't want to look like gluttons. Finally, Kroc gave in and approved supersized portions, and what followed was a dramatic rise in sales. People had been holding back because they didn't want to seem greedy. Now Wallerstein and McDonald's had figured out a way to make them feel okay about eating more. After all, it was still just one serving, even if it was twice the size. They had discovered the secret to expanding the supposedly fixed human stomach. One might think that people would stop eating and drinking these huge portions as soon as they felt full, but it turns out hunger doesn't work that way. Researchers have found that people, and animals, will eat up to 30% more if they are given larger portions. Our eating habits were formed over millions of years of evolution. Early humans, who lived by hunting and gathering, didn't always have enough food. Our bodies tell us to eat more when we have the chance, because hunger might be just around the corner. The problem is that with the mountain of cheap corn, hunger never comes, at least not for most Americans. In the same way, our built-in instincts tell us to eat lots of sugar and fat. Humans, like most other warm-blooded creatures, have a built-in sweet tooth. The taste of sweet or fat tells our body we're eating an energy-rich food. Our instinct is to eat as much as we can, in case we can't find food tomorrow. Yet in nature, we would never find a fruit with anywhere near the amount of fructose in a soda. We would never find a piece of animal flesh with as much fat as a chicken nugget. You begin to see why processing foods is such a good way of getting people to eat more. The fast food chains have been able to build foods that push our evolutionary buttons. Huge amounts of sweets and fats fool our instincts, and we wind up eating much more than we should. Animal experiments prove this is so. Rats presented with solutions of pure sugar or tubs of pure lard will gorge themselves sick. From here, we move on to chapter 10, which starts on page 111. Chapter 10. This is the Industrial Organic Meal, Part 2 of The Omnivore's Dilemma. Big Organic, Once Upon a Time. I'm certainly not the only one who has learned the truth about the industrial food chain. In recent years, more and more Americans have discovered the same sad facts. A lot of them are trying to get away from the kingdom of corn and processed foods by buying organic food. And in my part of the world, there is no greater temple to all things organic, natural, and unprocessed than my local Whole Foods supermarket. I confess that I really enjoy shopping at Whole Foods. It has some of the same feeling as browsing a good bookstore. Maybe that's because at Whole Foods I spend a lot of my time reading. Not books, but labels. Every food item in the store seems to have a little story attached to it. Take the range-fed sirloin steak in the meat case. There's a flyer on the counter that says once upon a time the steak was part of a steer that spent its days living in beautiful places. Among the places the steer got to visit were high mountain meadows, thick aspen groves, and miles of sagebrush-filled flats. Now a steak like that has got to taste better than one without a story. You can bet it will cost more, too. These food stories are showing up everywhere. On a recent shopping trip, I filled my shopping cart with eggs from cage-free veterinarian hens, milk from cows that live free from unnecessary fear and distress, wild salmon caught by Native Americans in Yakutat, Alaska, population 833, heirloom tomatoes from Capay Valley Farm, $4.99 a pound, one of the early pioneers of the organic movement. The organic chicken I picked even had a name, Rosie. Rosie was a free-range chicken from Petaluma Poultry. Almost all of the labels featured the word organic. 40 years ago, there was no such category as organic food. Today, it is a $20 billion business, the fastest-growing part of the food industry. The word organic has become kind of shorthanded for food that is healthier or more natural or chemical-free. Yet, as I had learned, organic has different meanings. Now I had more questions than answers. For example, can there be such a thing as organic TV dinner? What about an organic Twinkie? Exactly how different is organic food from industrial food? Well, I was about to find out. the birth of organic food. Once upon a time, all food was organic and was grown without the help of fossil fuels, pesticides, or chemical fertilizers. And as we've seen, that all began to change about 50 years ago with the growth of the industrial food chain. One of the first to notice this change was a man named J.I. Rodale. In 1940, he started a magazine called Organic Gardening and Farming. In his magazine, Rodale wrote about the health benefits of growing food without synthetic chemicals, organically. But the idea of organic food did not really catch on until 1969. That year marked the height of the counterculture of the 1960s. Civil rights and anti-war protests rocked the country. Young people were rebelling against a society they thought was violent, corrupt, and immoral. Some dropped out to join communes, groups of people living and working on farms. One part of this counterculture was the environmental movement. It was spurred in part by a 1962 book called Silent Spring by a woman named Rachel Carson. In it, she warned of the dangers of pesticides like DDT. Events in the news in 1969 also made people aware of the dangers of pollution. A giant oil spill off Santa Barbara blackened California's coastline. A river in Cleveland was so full of filth that it caught fire. Suddenly, people started using the word ecology and talking about cleaning up the planet. The first Earth Day was held in April of 1970, and the idea of organic food began to catch on. Eating whole wheat bread and whole grains like brown rice became a symbol of the new movement. Processed foods like white breads was called plastic food. The first organic food co-ops were founded. Neighbors would get together once a week and order organic vegetables from farmers. They had to agree on what to order. Often they bought whatever the local farmers had to offer. To the young people who founded the first co-ops, the word organic meant more than a method of farming. It meant living in harmony with nature instead of trying to control it. It meant being free from the control of big corporations. Growing organic food was a way to live their principles and not just talk about them. Most of the food co-ops are gone now. Many of them have been driven out of business by national organic supermarket chains like Whole Foods. Today in the average supermarket, there's a selection of organic fruits and vegetables flowing in from all over the world. You can buy organics at any time of the year, no matter the season, and you don't have to get a dozen other people to agree on what to buy. Industrial organic. But if you look a little closer, you'll see that something has been left behind. The organic food in stores like Whole Foods is organic because it is grown without chemical fertilizers or pesticides, yet much of it is also industrial. Most organic vegetables in the U.S. are grown in large monoculture farms, farms growing only one crop, far from the people who eat it. Most of it is processed and sold by the same industrial food chain as the corn from George Naylor's farm. Because this food chain has elements of both, I call it industrial organic. For example, some organic milk comes from cows on small farms, but most organic milk comes from factory farms. The cows on these farms spend their time in a fenced lot eating organic grain, except for 3 times a day they are hooked up to milking machines. Likewise, organic beef is often raised in organic feedlots. The cows are fed corn, just like the cows at Pokey, but their feed is organic. Government rules about organic food allow companies to make organic high fructose corn syrup, words I never expected to see combined. This organic high fructose corn syrup could come in useful when making organic processed foods, like organic soda or organic TV dinners. I found one such TV dinner that included 31 ingredients from guar and xanthan gum to natural grill flavor. Several of the ingredients were synthetic additives that are permitted under federal organic rules. Hippie food. The TV dinner was made by a company called Cascadian Farm. The story of Cascadian tells you a lot about the growth of the organic food movement and how it has changed. Cascadian started as the kind of hippie commune in 1972, founded by a fellow named Gene Kahn and his friends. Like other young people at the time, Kahn had an idea of getting back to the land and changing the American food system. Today, Cascadian is owned by General Mills, and Kahn is a General Mills vice president. Cascadian doesn't even grow its own food anymore. Instead, the company buys produce from large organic industrial farms, many of them monocultures. On the Cascadian package, there's a picture of a pretty little farm, the original commune. The place still exists, but it's just for show, I guess, so they can take photos of it. One overcast morning, Gene Kahn himself drove me out to see it, about 75 miles northeast of Seattle. We followed the twists of the Skagit River and the new forest green Lexus. His vanity license plates say, organic. Kahn is a boyish-looking man in his 50s. He spoke without regret about the compromises he's made along the path from organic farmer to agribusiness executive. He explained that part of the idea behind Cascadian was to get folks to eat whole foods instead of processed foods. They wanted people to be able to buy their food from local farmers instead of from big corporations. But somewhere along the way, Kahn decided that it was impossible to make all of those changes, so he decided to focus on how food was grown. You have a choice of getting sad about all that or moving on, he told me. We tried hard to build a cooperative community and local food system, but at the end of the day, it wasn't successful. This is just lunch for most people. Just lunch. Agribusiness moves in. So Khan, like some of other organic farmers, started following the model of the industrial food chain. Cascadian started adding value to some of its food by freezing berries or making them into jam. Once they started processing food, they discovered they could make more money by buying produce from other farmers than by growing it themselves. The demand for organic food really jumped in the year 1990, after the Aller food scare. Aller was a chemical conventional grower sprayed on apples to help them ripen. In 1990, the Environmental Protection Agency found that Aller could cause cancer. Suddenly, the demand for organic apples and all sorts of organic produce shot through the roof. People who had never thought about organic food started buying it. Organic food companies saw their businesses boom overnight. Some, like Cascadian, borrowed money to increase their production. Having borrowed too much when the rush to buy organic food slowed down, Gene Khan was forced to sell control of Cascadian to Welch's. The hippie commune was now under the control of corporate America. Other large agribusiness corporations started paying attention to organic food. It wasn't because they suddenly saw the error of their ways, they just recognized that a growing number of consumers wanted organic food, and they wanted a piece of that business. Gerber's, Heinz, Dole, ConAgra, and ADM all bought organic brands, or started their own. Growing by the rules. Now, all sorts of foods with labels like natural and organic began to show up in supermarkets. Those words had become great marketing tools. But what exactly did they mean? In 1990, Congress passed a law telling the Department of Agriculture, the USDA, to decide on some rules for organic food. What followed was a great debate to determine the future of the organic industry. On one side of the fight were the agribusiness corporations, which had just jumped onto the organic food bandwagon. They fought to define organic as loosely as possible. For example, they wanted the right to call genetically modified food, GMO, organic. They also wanted to be able to fertilize their organic fields with sewage sludge. At first, the USDA went along. In 1997, it proposed a very loose set of rules that gave agribusiness everything it wanted. In response, there was a huge outcry from small organic farmers and the public. A flood of protests forced the USDA back to the drawing board. One big question was whether there could be such a thing as organic processed food. Gene Khan sat on the board that set the new standards. He argued that the rules for organics had to allow synthetic additives and preservatives. Without synthetics, processed foods like TV dinners just can't be manufactured. Many people from the old organic movement argued that to put synthetics in a processed food and to call it organic was a fraud. They said there could be no such thing as a truly organic Twinkie or TV dinner. In the end, Khan's side won out. That's why there are now organic processed foods, although still no organic Twinkie. These new rules cleared the way for a huge growth in the organic food market. If we had lost on synthetics, Gene Khan told me, we'd be out of business. Down on the industrial organic farm. I guess I missed the old Cascadian, the one on the package, or at least I missed the idea of it. This just didn't fit my picture of what an organic farm should look like. Get over it, Gene Khan told me. Just because a farm is big doesn't mean it isn't organic. The important thing, he would argue, is that behind every organic TV dinner or chicken stands acres of land that will no longer be doused with chemicals. I could see his point. This is clearly a great thing for the environment and the public health, so I decided to go see some industrial organic farms for myself. Khan sent me to visit a large organic farm operation called Greenways in California's Central Valley. That's where they grow vegetables for Cascadian Farm frozen dinners. Greenways Organic is really 2,000 acres of organic farmland tucked into a 24,000-acre conventional farm. That gave me a chance to compare the two types of farming side by side. Even up close, it's almost impossible to tell them apart. The crops, the machines, the crews, the fields, and the fields look the same. The big difference is one you can't see. For every chemical that is put on the conventional fields, Greenways finds a substitute for the organic fields. In place of petrochemical fertilizers, Greenways organic acres are fed with compost from a nearby horse farm and by poultry manure. Instead of toxic pesticides, crops are sprayed with natural substances like BT, a pesticide made from a common soil bacteria. Organic weeding. Organic farming rules do not allow chemical weed killers, so Greenways has to use other methods to fight weeds. Even before the crops are planted, the fields are watered to get any weed seeds to grow. A tractor then plows the field to kill them. This is repeated several times. Later, when the crops are high, farm workers use propane torches to burn the weeds by hand. The result of all this hard work is fields that look just as clean as if chemical weed killers have been used. No chemical means no toxic runoff into rivers and oceans. But it turns out that plowing the land over and over damages the soil almost as much as chemical weed killers do. It kills off the nitrogen-fixing bacteria that make the soil fertile. It releases a lot of nitrogen into the air. Because of this damage, industrial organic farmers have to add a lot of nitrogen fertilizer to their fields. Where do they get it? From compost, manures, or fish meal. Most of the organic food sold in America comes from farms like Greenway. Supermarket chains like Whole Foods or Walmart are not set up to do business with dozens of small family-owned farms. It takes too much time and money to coordinate. It makes much more sense for them to buy from large suppliers like Cascadian. And for the same reason, it's much easier for Cascadian to buy its produce from large farms like Greenway's. To meet the demands of their customers, Greenway's has to farm on an industrial scale. It must plant one or two crop varieties that ripen at the same time. It must plant foods that can survive shipment across the country. It must buy fertilizer from someone else instead of getting it from animals on the farm. Again, Gene Kahn and many other people think this is just fine. After all, because of companies like his, thousands of acres of American farmland are now chemical-free. Organic food can now be found in most supermarkets. Surely that's a very good thing. Let us sell you lettuce. I learned more about the industrial organic system when I visited Earthbound Farms. Earthbound grows 80% of the organic lettuce sold in America. You may have seen some of it in plastic boxes in your supermarket. You could argue that Earthbound represents industrial organic farming at its best. The company was started in the 1980s by Drew and Myra Goodman, two farmers who started with exactly no farming experience. They are childhood friends from New York City who started dating back when they both went to college in California. During a break before going to grad school, they started a roadside organic farm on a few rented acres growing raspberries and baby salad greens. Every Sunday, Myra would wash and bag a bunch of lettuce for their own use, a salad for each night of the week. They discovered that the whole leaf lettuce stayed fresh right through to dinner the following Saturday. So began the pre-washed salad business in America. Before the Goodmans, salad for most Americans meant iceberg lettuce. They introduced dozens of different salad mixes to mainstream America. Along the way, they changed the way lettuces were grown, and harvested, cleaned, and packed. And today, Earthbound is a company that takes in $400 million a year. I met Myra Goodman, now a tanned, talkative 42-year-old, over a lunch at the company's roadside stand in Carmel Valley. Unlike Cascadian Farm, Earthbound still grows most of its own produce. Most of its farmland is an hour northeast of Carmel in the Salinas Valley. That fertile valley is cooled by sea breezes, making it an ideal spot for growing lettuces 9 months of the year. In winter, the company picks up and moves its operations and many of its employees south to Yuma, Arizona. Myra explained that Earthbound Farms' growth exploded in 1993. That's when the Costco chain placed an order. Costco was moving 2,000 cases a week to start, Myra said, and the orders kept increasing. Other chains like Walmart, Lucky, and Albertsons soon followed. The Goodmans realized their days of washing lettuce in the living room were over. We didn't know how to farm on that scale, Drew told me. We needed a lot more land, fast. So the Goodmans entered into partnership with growers who knew how to grow, harvest, pack, and distribute large quantities of produce. As part of the deal, the growers had to agree to change to organic farming methods. If you include all the farmland, growing fruits and vegetables for Earthbound, it comes to a total of 25,000 organic acres. The Goodmans estimate that this has eliminated some 270,000 pounds of pesticide and 8 million pounds of petrochemical fertilizer that would otherwise have been applied to those fields. The salad factory. The Earthbound farm land looks like a giant patchwork of color. Dark green, burgundy, pale green, blue green. Each color block is a different type of lettuce. The lettuce is grown and raised beds. Each bed is 80 inches wide and smooth and flat as tabletop. Workers use a laser to make sure they are perfectly level. That is so custom-built harvester can snip each leaf at precisely the same point. To control pests, out of every 7 beds is planted with flowers. The flowers attract lacewings, a type of fly that eats the lettuce-eating bugs. Pesticides, even the ones allowed by USDA organic rules, are seldom sprayed. The leaves are harvested with a machine that Earthbound designed. It moves down the rows, cutting the baby greens at the same point just above the crown. Spidery arms gently rake through the bed in advance of the blade, scaring off any mice that might find their way into the salad. The leaves are blown into plastic trays, and the trays are loaded by hand into refrigerator trucks. From that point, they will be refrigerated until they reach your supermarket. Once filled, the trucks deliver their cargo of leaves to a processing plant. There, the leaves are sorted, mixed, washed, dried, and packaged. The whole plant is kept at 36 degrees. Because of the refrigeration, the employees, most of them Mexicans, are dressed in full-length down coats. The plant washes and packs 2.5 million pounds of lettuce a week. That's a truly amazing amount of lettuce. It also represents a truly amazing amount of energy. Think of the electricity bill to refrigerate a 200,000 square foot plant. Think of the diesel fuel needed to truck all that salad to supermarkets across the country or to manufacture the plastic containers it's packed in. A 1 pound box of pre-washed lettuce contains 80 calories of food energy. Growing, chilling, washing, packaging, and transporting that box of organic salad to a plate on the East Coast takes more than 4,600 calories of fossil fuel energy, or 57 calories of fossil fuel energy for every calorie of food. What could be more healthy than eating a salad? It's basically a bunch of leaves eaten raw. And organic salad has to be even better, right? Still, the idea of packing lettuce in plastic boxes and shipping it 5 days and 3,000 miles away didn't feel very organic to me. Like Gene Kahn, Drew and Myra Goodman make no apologies for the way they do business. Their company has done a world of good for its land, its workers, the growers it works with, and its customers. But is this kind of organic the best we can do? Before I could make up my mind, I had to visit one more organic farm. I was on my way to meet Rosie, the organic chicken. That is the end of this reading assignment. Next, we'll be on to Chapter 11 in Reading Assignment 5.